thanks so much for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and you know what? It's a physical therapy day. And our physical therapists are back. Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody back with us. Jill, a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Jill, good to see your smiling face.
It's great to be here on this sunny day.
Lori is a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And Lori, good to see you as well.
It is awesome to be here.
We will start by talking about who among us is at a higher risk of maybe breaking bones and maybe wrists. And we'll hear about some new guidelines for rehabilitation after a wrist fracture. So, what questions do you have for our guests? What's ailing you these days? Have you had a wrist injury or maybe a broken wrist? Love to hear from you. Or your other ache or pain or ailment, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Let's talk about wrist fractures to begin with. Distal radius fractures, I think they're called. Mm-hmm.
That's right. So in your forearm, you have two bones. One is the radius, which is the kind of the bigger bone of the two. It's on the thumb side of your wrist. And then the other bone is the ulna on the little finger side of it. And when you turn your palm up, say for example, you are at the drive-thru and you're reaching out the window with your left arm to get your change, those forearm bones need to cross over each other so you can turn your palm up. So having good mobility in your forearm is really important. And also that radius bumps up against some bones in your wrist that if fractured, have a high incidence of non-union, and they're adjacent to your thumb, which is, of course, what separates us from lower mammals, that opposable thumb.
Sure. Right.
So that distal meaning end, down at the wrist end of it, radial fracture can affect a lot of things. Your ability to turn your palm up and get your change, and your ability to grasp and use your thumb.
Right. And I think about things like turning a key in a car, opening a doorknob, all of those things.
Sure.
Getting dressed, buttons, zippers, tying things, all of those things require very intricate hand function.
So how often do we see these?
Well, I don't have a specific number for you, but what can tell you is a distal radius fracture in the aging population, particularly postmenopausal women, is fairly high due to a fall. So between the hip, the lumbar spine, and the distal radius, those are three of the big sites where we see osteoporosis as we age. So that puts this joint or this bone at risk.
You see, you work with athletes a lot.
I do.
Do you see it much with athletes?
We do if the athlete is somebody who has like a high energy fall, or for example, a football player who has a high explosive push into someone like that. In those conditions where the bone is really healthy, it has to be a really high energy trauma. And Lori's son had one playing soccer.
Right.
Yeah.
He fell in goal and landed on his outstretched hand. We call it a foosh, fall in an outstretched hand. And he had what's called a buccal fracture of his distal radius. And we were in Milwaukee on a cold night. And I looked at him and I, for some reason, didn't have my medical kit with me. So I called a buddy of mine who lives in Lake Mills and I said, meet me at the Walgreens with a Sam splint and some ice. And we iced him up. And, you know, because he was young, he was casted. And when he came out of his cast, I basically told him, do this, 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 and this. And that was it. He recovered nicely because he was young and healthy. But we don't see the same thing in the elderly population. For example, you have underlying osteoporosis and arthritis, and all of a sudden you have this fall affecting the distal radius, and you're immobilized. and now the arthritis at the base of your thumb is screaming at you.
No.
So
you know right away.
Right, right.
There's something wrong.
Right. Well, the immobilization causes other secondary problems in the older individual. So
I wonder about nerve damage. Do you get nerve damage from somebody?
You could be at risk for nerve damage of the radial nerve if the fracture was significantly displaced. In other words, if the bones came fairly far apart and would hit a nerve. But I don't know that you wrist drop that often.
Richard
in Two Rivers has a question that relates right to all of this.
Okay.
So let's just go there, and then we'll talk about the new rehab guidelines. Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, hey. How you doing, Larry?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I've fractured both wrists many times. I mean, I'm not proud of it, you know, a bicycle or a motorcycle or whatever. And I ended up having, and I want to ask your guest if they ever heard of this before. I not only was a physical therapist, but I worked at Mayo Clinic.
Okay.
And I had a Ganser muscle, it's an accessory muscle, and it goes off your flexor.
It's a wrist muscle.
It goes past the wrist. And it tore, and I knew it was bad because it was killing the nerve that it wrapped around. And to make it simple and to make it less complicated, it did it on my right wrist. And the only reason why I had it repaired was because I needed to. And now it happened to my left wrist. And I don't know if they ever heard of that before. It took Mayo Clinic like 6 months to figure it out.
That's understandable because I've never seen a Ganser muscle nor that muscle injured, but it is an accessory muscle in your forearm. That's an anatomical variation of what's called the flexor pollicis longus muscle. So that's one of the muscles that moves your thumb. So it's understandable that they had difficulty diagnosing this because it's very rare. So, and you can, it can get compression of the anterior interosseous nerve.
Which is a branch off the median nerve.
Which is a branch off the median nerve. So you can have this nerve pain. So it's understandable that it was complex and it took a long time to uncover.
Right.
You know, it's a zebra. So, you know, when you have a fracture, especially someone like you who's had multiple fractures, it's easy to say, well, you know, you fractured this before, there's scar tissue, there's damage from previous injuries, et cetera, and to pass it off as that. But it does show the importance of being diligent about, you know, continuing to say, you know, I've had this before, this feels different, there's something different about this one, et cetera.
Yeah.
So are you doing well now, Richard?
Except for it was the only reason why I had it fixed. And I have a scar from my wrist all the way up to my elbow.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, they had to figure it out.
Right.
To look for it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Well, good for you for sticking with it. And I assume you're still doing some exercises to maintain your wrist and hand function.
I hope so. Richard, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, it kind of gets us into the rehab part of this,
right,
Jill. And there are some new rehab guidelines.
Yes. We have clinical practice guidelines on other conditions, and what it is it's a compilation of all of the research and data regarding this condition, and then it is assessed and basically rated as valued. Like grade A is the best or most solid evidence, down to like, you know, grade D or grade F, like use with caution. So the clinical practice guidelines for the distal radius fracture are brand new. This is our first go around at them. And I think we found some things that are relatively interesting and also appropriate. So one of a few things that kind of stuck out and had really good evidence were that therapy should be initiated at the hand, wrist, and shoulder within the first 3 weeks after a surgically repaired fracture, as soon as it's stable, basically. And so I think the take-home message for this was, as Lori alluded to, if this is immobilized too long, we can end up with very negative sequelae at other joints. In other words, it can negatively impact your elbow. It can negatively impact your shoulder. The other evidence that I thought was interesting, which got a grade of B, is that people who are over the age of 60 or those with complications should have supervised therapy at least once a week or greater than one time per week prior to kind of getting cut loose on a home exercise program. And again, my guess is with that, with the evidence behind that, is because this age population, what Lori talked about earlier, is at such great risk of impaired mobility at the elbow, impaired mobility at the shoulder, yeah, things sure. like that. Mm-hmm. So, A, you should start your rehab relatively early. And B, if you're over the age of 60, you need to be in a well-supervised program by a clinician until they feel it's comfortable to kind of cut you loose a little bit. Those were two kind of what I thought were really good findings mm-hmm. from this.
How long does this this whole process take to, healing process, I should say?
In general, healing of a fracture in, you know, a perfect situation, you're looking at 6 weeks mm-hmm. for the fracture to be stable enough to be a little more aggressive with your therapy. So that's, again, in an ideal world. And I really want to emphasize that starting therapy early. I have a student right now who's an occupational therapist who's doing her work on the stiff hand.
Mm.
And her premise is physicians and patients need to be educated mm-hmm. about the importance of early mobility and how it will not disrupt the healing process if done correctly. It's just mobility, you know, recognizing that joints and other connective tissue need to move. And so if they're immobilized, even if you're fingers are not immobilized because your wrist is immobilized, people tend to not use
right.
it. And so educating the physicians that they need to refer those patients to therapy, to just educate that patient on the things they need to do to prevent developing a stiff hand.
There's so many muscles and tendons that cross multiple joints at our wrist and hand that you get what I call collateral damage. You know, you may have a fracture in your wrist, but all those finger tendons that Lori's alluding to get immobilized through no fault of their own, just by location. And so I'm guessing that's what your OT student is mm-hmm. is trying to advocate for. And the other thing along those lines I think is really important is to get that appointment scheduled.
No.
Because, you know, a physician will say, okay, you know, you can start moving. And you go to call and make an appointment. And unfortunately, there may be a 3-week wait. And that could mm-hmm. be very deleterious to somebody who's post-immobilization.
So you want to make that appointment before?
Well, you don't know you're going to fall.
Yeah,
right.
You don't know.
Right.
But when you do.
But when you, you know, when you're talking mm-hmm. to the physician and managing the fracture, it's important that you get a handle on the timeline and say, you know, should I make an appointment for 3 or 4 weeks out? It's easy to cancel an appointment. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to create one.
Absolutely true.
But just this whole early, you know, getting going early, it goes along with all other kinds, many, many other kinds of.
Oh, my. Yeah. Can I just say how old I am?
Are you going to tell the Don Shelbourne story with the ACLs and the casts?
Oh, yeah. 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 I didn't know it was a Don Shelbourne story.
But you want to get up and going. And
absolutely.
I mean, that's sort of the thing to do now.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I've been around long enough where they used to immobilize patients after ACL reconstructions for weeks, up to 12 weeks,
they would immobilize in
a cast.
With your knee bent.
With your knee slightly bent. And then getting that knee range of motion back was almost impossible. And there was so much damage to the articular cartilage, so much weakness in all the muscles surrounding the knee. It was almost impossible to get that motion back again.
And do you know how they discovered, Lori, as a, just a follow-up to why we should be moving these people, is Don Shelbourne, who's a very well-respected orthopedic surgeon who did his residency here, actually had patients who were non-compliant.
Non-compliant.
They would get in the bathtub and soak their casts off and move earlier, and they actually had better outcomes. Yeah. And he wrote a paper on, we need to really rethink how we're managing these individuals. So,
Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our physical therapist, with us today. If you have a question, we've been talking about wrists, but we can certainly deal with other issues as well. The number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us. The email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. At 12:30 today, we'll talk to a surgeon and a medical physics researcher about their work on a new kind of treatment for injuries from burns. That's at 12:30. Right now, we're talking aches, pains, sprains, and strains, I guess. We zeroed in on wrists to start with, but taking other questions as well at 1-800-642-1234. Or email to talk@WPR.org. Julie emailed to say they are 63, find it very hard to do anything like yoga or push-ups because their wrists hurt. Julie has worked at a computer for many years, still does, but finding it very hard to do anything like yoga or push-ups because the wrists hurt.
Yeah, weight bearing through the wrist joints can be very painful, especially if you're lacking some of that range of motion. I know you can use those little blocks, or there's some adaptive equipment you can get that keep your wrists in neutral versus having to put your palms so flat that help. I know some people will, like on the treatment tables, for example, will curl their fingers around the edge of the table because they just don't have enough mobility to perfectly lay their hands flat. I don't know, what else have you seen?
Those are the big modifications that I've seen. And so, you know, the question is there something that should be done about the wrist to keep it healthy for the rest of your life? And perhaps a visit or two to a physical therapist or occupational therapist who specializes in hand and wrist could give you a few suggestions to try to open up the world of your exercise in the future. But yeah, we typically, for people that have, you know, arthritis in their wrist and thumb and don't have that motion, we use those adaptive positions that you discussed.
Mary in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Mary.
Hi, Larry. I broke one wrist gardening during COVID, and that I had just gotten a cast off, and then I broke the other wrist biking. The two things I did the most during COVID, I had never broken a bone before. So that the good news was, then they said, you better do a bone density. Sure enough, I was a candidate for the medication I take once a week, and I've been doing that for a while, and I've had a repeat scan, and it looks like that maybe helped my bone loss. But I'm curious, is that something I'm going to be on now for the rest of my life, or is there a way I can, if I take more pills, I can really get my bones back up to good shape? Or just any information about that, if that's something you know about.
Jill, go ahead.
Sure. So taking a medication to increase your bone mineral density is fantastic, but one of the best ways is to increase your BMD is through exercise and weight-bearing activities. And biking, although wonderful cardiovascularly, does not increase your bone mineral density. There's no loading of the bones with it. And so you would need to add to your regimen some weight-bearing and resistance training exercises, which a physical therapist could could prescribe for you and get that done. And I know I'm looking at Lori and she's...
Oh, I know. I'm just thinking. No, I didn't. I didn't check out. I'm thinking because, you know, I ride my bike to work.
Me too.
So you are... I absolutely agree 100%. You're not increasing your bone density in your hips and legs, but you're weight bearing on your hands.
You are.
And I'm wondering... So I just had this thought.
Oh, that's what was going on over there.
That's what was going on over there. I'm thinking, I haven't seen any research on whether or not weight bearing on your hands, biking, and that bit of vibration you get helps with your bone density in your wrist, and maybe we should do
that'd be fun.
And you get some weight bearing through your tush, maybe to your lumbar spine a little bit. So, but I'm curious how you fractured your wrist gardening. Please,
So I have these gigantic pots that I put like those elephant ears and canna bulbs in, and I take them on a dolly in the fall and cut them down and get them ready for winter. And the dolly is a little bit small for them. So I'm backing up, and I've done it every year and not had, but this time it slipped and sent me flying. And I happened to be on the concrete sidewalk.
A fall.
And so fall, and you put your outstretched your
hands. That's exactly right. Yeah. So the medication back to Mary and Lori instead of Lori's research study So the medication is very helpful, but I would definitely see a physical therapist. And I think you're in Madison, and I believe Lori at your clinic, do you have some people that specialize in osteoporosis?
Good
and luck.
Taking more medication is not the answer.
Correct.
No. Good luck, Mary. Thank you for calling. Bob in Claybanks. We'll go to you now. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having the show. Thank you, ladies. Two questions. A couple months ago, you mentioned an alternative to rotator cuff surgery, and that caught my ear. I was wondering if you could give me more details on that.
A treatment for rotator cuff?
Was it an alternative to a rotator cuff repair surgery? In other words, So I bet it was an arthroscopic debridement is what we talked about.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Or I'll go ahead.
Yeah,
okay,
you go ahead because you started.
Okay, fine. Thank you, older sister. So, Bob, what we were talking about was simply it's a surgical procedure, but it doesn't repair your rotator cuff. What they do is they go in and they do a debridement and they clean up the area. So if there's some fraying in your rotator cuff, they clean up that fraying. If there's some osteophytes or some osteo changes within the kind of the undersurface of your acromion or the undersurface of your roof of your shoulder, they'll clean that up and kind of create a bigger space. They may do a bursectomy and take out your subacromial bursa, which would also make more space. So it's still a surgical procedure, but they do not repair your rotator cuff, and outcomes are very good.
Yeah, and there we also were talking about the long head of the biceps relative to that. And so they may do a tenodesis and move the attachment of the long head of your biceps because it runs right in that small space where your rotator cuff is. So sometimes it's the long head of the biceps that's giving you grief, and so they will relocate that for you.
There you go.
Was that both questions? He said he had two questions.
I think that was it.
Hello, if I'm still there?
Yeah.
Which is the older sister?
Oh! Okay, now I think we're done probably, right?
Lori is just by a hair.
Oh, yeah.
By the older sister.
Very long hair.
A very long one.
We've never been asked that.
We haven't. No, well, it's because you usually tell people up front. So the fact that she tells you who's the younger.
There you go.
Bob, thanks for calling. Carrie in Verona, your turn. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. I have, I think, a high hamstring strain. My muscle under my left butt cheek is sore. I was at Blue Mound State Park trying out hiking poles for the first time, and I usually walk more flat or graduate hills, like 3 to 4 miles a day with my dog, spread over tree walks. But the issue is that my daughter and I are planning on a walk along Hadrian's Wall in about a month. So I'm wondering if you have any advice for me that I could keep walking but not exacerbate this injury?
I think you need to see someone.
Yeah.
So high hamstring tendinopathies are not uncommon, especially in women in that postmenopausal era. I don't know where you are with that, Carrie, but I would definitely see someone for this to get some exercises and all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, they're very difficult to treat.
Yes.
I can attest to that. And sorting out whether it's high hamstring or it's piriformis or what it is, because it may not actually be
sciatic,
a hamstring.
Sciatic.
Yeah, there are a lot of suspects on that list, especially if you've been walking hills. In the meantime, until you get in, I think you should continue to walk but shorten up your stride.
Mm-hmm. And no hills.
And no hills.
I would avoid hills if you could.
Yep.
There you go, Carrie. Get on the phone. Get that appointment.
That's right.
In the meantime, walk in flat areas. Mm-hmm. Peter in Amherst. Your turn. Hi, Peter.
Well, hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call today.
Sure.
And thanks for having your therapist on. I injured my wrist probably years ago. Have a little nodule on the back of my right hand. I'm right hand dominant. Went in to see a surgeon, and they wanted to fuse my bones together because I have no cartilage left. So I didn't think that sounded like a great idea because I'm pretty active. But the problem now is I don't have any grip strength left.
Oh.
And even when I try to golf, I have trouble. And even like you said with your last person about push-ups, I used to bike and I still bike and weightlift, but I'm having a lot of problems maintaining strength in that right hand. And then, of course, it flares up. But my first question is, should I get all the bones fused? That sounds kind of bad. Or is there therapy to help with that bone-on-bone that's in my wrist?
So that's a great question. It sounds to me like you have some underlying instability.
Mm-hmm. Scapholunate.
Scapholunate or a central column, something like that. So, yes, I would, if you have not seen either a physical therapist or an occupational therapist, I would find someone who is a certified hand therapist. It could be either a PT or an OT who specializes in this. Because what Lori and I are both thinking is that two of the bones in your carpal row, those kind of that row, that really foster stability. When you grip things, you need the central column of your hand, which is your middle finger. That row has to be really, really stable so you can curve your hand around and pick up different objects, use good dexterity. And my guess is you're a little unstable there. And so seeing a hand therapist and really exhausting conservative care would be the first thing I would do before I'd go for a fusion.
Right. And the other thing to remember is, again, get a second opinion on the surgery. But it's unlikely they're going to fuse all the bones in your wrist, but probably just those bones that are unstable.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to deal with this before you lose any more grip strength because you may not get it back. So get some clarity on what they're talking about for surgery and what the risks and benefits are before you dismiss it out of hand.
And an experienced hand surgeon. Hand surgeon.
Right. And an experienced hand therapist
for
who
sure.
has seen this before, who can also give you good advice based upon what they are seeing when they examine you.
Correct.
And I would think in the meantime, you might want to go with larger grips on your clubs.
There you go.
So absolutely. So it might be, I mean, anytime your grip is either too big or too small, that's when you run into a lot of issues with stability. So you might have to change your grip a little bit, things like that. And it's his dominant hand, which is a big deal. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
Good luck with that, Peter. Appreciate your call. Ken in Fond du Lac, your turn. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've had just recently a tendinosis surgery where they moved the tendon over, and then they did some cleanup. And in a very short period of time, in my hand, I got a neuropathy from about the wrist. It went into the thumb and into the forefinger and then into the middle finger. And I went to physical therapy, and then I went to occupational therapy, the hand therapist, and we got to a point where now there's just a little bit of dead nerve feeling in the tip of the finger, and I was wondering what and where that I can continue to work on that.
So what tendon did they move? So you said
bicep.
You had a Oh, the long head of the biceps?
Oh, you had a tenodesis of your biceps and ended up with this hand stuff. Oh, I got to rethink this now.
Yeah.
So I was thinking it was like ulnar something. Okay.
Yeah, so it's unusual that you would have a shoulder surgery and end up with numbness in your hand. What did they ascribe that to? Were you immobilized after that, or?
Very short period of time of immobilization.
Okay.
And I was in open sling.
Okay.
And I was doing rapid, pretty soon after, you know, days, I was, you know, they gave me a ball and I worked on the ball to squeeze the ball for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, I called and I spoke to the surgeon's nurse and she got back to me and they said that they think that might be attributed to carpal tunnel.
Well, it depends upon where the numbness is.
So,
and also wonder when it started after surgery, because it could have been due to the position that he was in during the surgical procedure.
I always wonder about that as well, too, if it was that, or if with the sling it changed, it pulled him forward, if it changed his neck position.
Right.
So this there could be multiple things here causing this, I think, Ken.
But I think walking it back and saying, okay, you just have numbness in the tip of your fingers now, you're seeing a certified hand therapist.
Right.
You've seen a physical therapist.
Right.
Those are the people who have worked with you over time and seen how you respond to different interventions who are best able to give you the prognosis on this, far better than we are, because we don't really know what caused it, nor have we seen how things have changed over time with different interventions.
But what we can say with regarding to the neuropathy is that you're going to get your sensation back proximal to distal. So now that you're just at the end of your fingertips is a really, in my mind, a really good sign. I don't know if that will come back. We always know that kind of the end of things takes longer to come back. So that I can't tell you, but the fact that you're down to the tips of your fingers, I think is frustrating for you, but good news.
Yeah.
Ken, good luck. Thank you for calling. Julie in Lincoln, Nebraska. Your turn. Hi, Julie.
Hello. I'm wondering if you can give some advice on how to fall. I had a friend, we were out walking. He tripped. He fell forward, and afterwards he explained that he didn't want to break his wrist, so he tucked his arm into his body and proceeded to crack up a couple of ribs.
You know, it's a rob Peter to pay Paul thing.
It is,
so,
yeah.
You know, typically they tell you to fall to the side and to land on the largest, fleshiest parts of your body. So depending upon your soma type, that may vary. But typically, yeah, you don't want to fall forward if you can avoid it, because you'll injure your wrist or shoulder. And if they're unable to break the fall, you're going to face plant. So if you can tuck and roll sideways, that would be the preferred way to fall if you're going to fall.
Right. And there, just as a side note, falling is such a big deal because it does lead to all of these morbidities. One of the things that we have in Dane County every year is something called Only Leaves Should Fall, and you can get screened for falling. And so just along these lines, Julie, I would encourage people to look in their area to see if there's some sort of, seminar, whatever, some screening where you could get screened, and then they can also make recommendations for you there as well. But yeah, as a general rule, it's tuck and roll on the fleshiest part.
Yeah.
But that screening is a pretty good idea.
It's
actually
great. Yeah, it's wonderful.
If you're concerned.
Exactly.
And here at UW, there's also a class. I don't remember how long it goes, but they meet once a week and they go over some exercises to work on falling.
Mm-hmm.
And along that line, just as a note, it is really important to be able to get back up. especially here in Wisconsin. So I had a student who did some research on falling and found that the inability to get back up was linked to frailty.
Right.
And lack of independence, and people and requiring living assistance. So it's a really important skill. And I know people who have had knee replacements, mm-hmm. for example, have a hard time getting back up, and they'll say, oh, I can't get back up. And, you know, these are relatively young people. I'm like, we have to help you figure out a way
right.
to get
you
up.
Have
because
to have a strategy.
What happens when you walk out your back door mm-hmm. to let your dog out in the winter mm-hmm. and you go down and you're back there without your phone because mm-hmm. you left it in the house because you were just going to let the dog out and you can't get back up? Mm-hmm. It's a life-threatening situation here.
Right. And a lot of those fall, that's one of the things those fall courses will teach you is how to get back up either with or even without any equipment mm-hmm. or anything like that, because you need to be able to get up off the floor without any assistance, any chair, any bed, anything like that. And I'm going to tell you, once a month I do it just to make sure I still can, because Lori told me this and I thought, oh my gosh. So about once a month I'll sit on the floor and I'll make sure I can get up off the floor without any help.
Oh, aren't you a big girl? All right.
Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum from the UW-Madison, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for listening in to WPR News. Tomorrow at this time, I will be at the Larry Mueller Show. We'll be broadcasting from the Wise Nature Center at the Beaver Creek Reserve in Fall Creek. Matter of fact, I'm going to be driving up that way this afternoon at some point. We'll talk to Reserve Center naturalists. We'll talk about birds. We'll talk about butterflies. We'll talk about the reserve itself. And then for the second hour of the show, we'll be joined by author, humorist, and singer-songwriter Michael Perry.
Oh, gosh.
Love Michael.
Yeah, yeah, so funny.
So it'll be a fun hour there as well. That's tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show. It's part of our trips around the state of Wisconsin.
That is so much fun. Mm-hmm. We should do that biking, Larry.
Mm-hmm.
You can bike. That's going to be a lot of biking because next week we'll be in Plover on Monday.
Okay.
And then I think a week after that, maybe, or 2 weeks after that, we'll be in La Crosse.
There's
a lot of biking going on.
There's a lot of biking. Yeah.
Well, we have enough of my trips around the state. Let's take another call here as we talk physical therapy with Lori and Jill. Jennifer in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I am 51 years old and just found out I have severe osteoarthritis in my hip and need to have hip replacement surgery. So I've been adjusting to that. But what I found, they recommended that I walk with a crutch, and I find that I'm stooping over too much with that. I'm looking for advice about better mobility devices or if I should be using them while I wait for surgery. And also for some ideas for maintaining I find I'm getting stiffer because I'm not doing enough activities. I'm thinking of walking in the pool or something. Mm-hmm. Looking for some advice.
Oh, Lori just got excited when you said walking in the pool.
Yeah, sure did.
So the first thing is I would make sure your crutches are fitted appropriately because that may be part of the problem. You should be using your crutch on the opposite side. And if you stand up nice and tall, you should be able to fit maybe 2 to 3 fingers under your armpit with the crutch out at a diagonal from your pinky toe of about 6 inches. That makes sense.
So aim the crutch.
So it should be it's not straight in front of your toe and it's not straight at a 90 degrees. But if you take it about 6 inches at a 45 degree angle from your pinky toe, standing up nice and tall. 2 to 3 fingers under your armpit, and then when you rest your arm on the crutch, the bar that you hold on to should come to about your wrist. So you have a little bit of elbow flexion as you crutch with it.
So are you using the crutch at home, or what are you? When are
so
you?
I've gotten varying advice from different people.
Okay.
The guy that diagnosed me said, "Don't use the crutch." The physical therapist said, "Do use the crutch." This other guy I'm working with said, "Don't use the crutch." So I'm kind of like, "What, you know?"
But are you limping?
I'm limping. It's terrible. I walk like a penguin.
Then you need to use a.
You need an assistive device of some sort.
Yeah.
So you know, the thing about a crutch is that it leaves one hand free. And, you know, the other option is walking poles, but that requires 2 hands. So it's less convenient around home. But if you don't have stuff to carry, walking poles will keep you a little more upright.
Right, and not bent.
And not bent forward. So, and in terms of your second question, absolutely get in a pool. There are lots of pools in the community where you can get in and walk, and or in the, if you're not adverse to the deep end, getting in the deep end and doing deep water running just for mobility and some cardio and to maintain your body weight. You want to be as healthy as you can be before you go into your hip replacement. You want to maintain as much hip range of motion as you can prior to your surgery.
Right.
There you go, Jennifer.
Good
thanks
luck.
So much. Yeah, thanks so much for calling. And I've just been reminded that, back to falls for just a second, we are doing a fall prevention show, and that's coming up soon. We've got more details to come on that, though.
Great.
Nice.
Wonderful.
So we're
that's
doing
wonderful.
A segment
perfect.
On that.
Perfect.
Cheryl in Sturgeon Bay, we go to you. Hi, Cheryl.
Hello, this is Cheryl. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
In May, I broke my wrist, and I broke the radius bone. So had a splint and then a cast for a month, and then was put in a brace for another month. So when the doctor put me in the brace, and she said, in 1 month, come back, and we'll see if you have any soft tissue injuries. Because the problem that I was having was I had all of this pain on the pinky side, pinky finger side, and no pain where the bone was broken.
Interesting.
So, I started physical therapy, and at 3 weeks, I was told I could lift as much weight as needed. So, you know, I was feeling like, okay, I'm really exercising well and getting stronger, but I had a lot of pain. So then when I did go back at the 12-week mark to the doctor, I told her about the pain, and then she had an MRI done. And I have a ligament that's torn.
Oh, your TFCC.
And I'm wondering why is it done in that order, and with the physical therapist, you know, not knowing that I had a torn tendon. Kind of wondering.
So I think you mentioned a torn ligament, which is different than a torn tendon, Cheryl?
Yes, she said ligament.
Okay, so it's probably the TFCC, which is on the pinky side of the hand. It is your triangular fibrocartilaginous complex, which is a myriad of very small ligaments that offer stability on the ulnar side or pinky side of your hand.
Right. And the reason they're done in that order is the fracture rules
supersedes,
the day.
Yes.
Supersedes everything else. And, you know, if you fell on an outstretched hand, are you going to damage some soft tissue? Obviously. Absolutely you are. If you fall hard enough to fracture a bone, you're going to sustain some soft tissue damage as well. The hope is that the immobilization allows that soft tissue to heal at the same time the fracture's healing, and then you start therapy and start loading these things, and everything comes along together. So if you have, you know, significant soft tissue damage, well, then it's going to show up at the end. Would it change the order of treatment and how it was treated?
No, it
wouldn't. But now you've sort of dealt with one thing, the fracture is healed, and now you need to deal with the secondary damage that happened. But in terms of how things were handled, I think it was handled as it should be.
I do. I call it peeling layers off the onion. Mm-hmm. So this is, like Lori said, the fracture rules everything. So, okay, that's cleaned up. Maybe that soft tissue soreness was just due to stiffness. So you get you moving a little bit. Okay, maybe it clears up, maybe it doesn't. If it doesn't, again, that's where this algorithm comes in and they discover these other things. For some people, you know, you get moving and it goes away. So, I agree with Laura. I think the sequence makes sense to me, and I know sometimes it's frustrating when you're like, gosh, I thought everything was in my rearview mirror and now I have this.
Right.
So it can be frustrating.
Right. There was no other intervention for that injury at that point in time other than immobilization.
Right, I would have immobilized a TFCC too. Yep.
Yeah.
Cheryl, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Let's go to KR in Madison next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you. This may be an unpopular question, but there's a lot of us out here waiting to get physical therapy or occupational therapy appointments, but they're moved out 4, 5, 6 months, and we're dealing with things that are really compromising the way that we're living. And obviously, some people have said, use it or lose it, can't use it. Right on the cusp of being old enough that losing it is going to cause more and more problems.
Right.
My question is, is there any national or online PTOT diagnostic services that can be accessed by people when our own networks can't provide the services that we need?
Yeah.
Well, thank you for bringing up the elephant in the room.
Right.
Because Jill and I like to say, oh, go see a physical therapist as if you could call up and see somebody next week.
Right.
Yeah. Doesn't work that way.
Right.
So I would start with the local network, and I would complain, and I would have my friends complain, and I would write letters to the editor. I would make this a fairly public issue because it is an issue. And I know from personal experience and where I work what the wait time is. And for those of us that are providers, I assure you we are equally as frustrated with the limited access. So, you know, other options are to go outside, if you can, to a private practice. There are definitely private practices in Dane County. The issue being, if you are in a managed care program, you know, a lot of those places don't accept managed care. And it's not because those private clinics don't want to take managed care. It's that managed care won't contract with
them.
So just know that that's not on the provider side. That's, again, on the managed care side. So complain to those people.
Right.
In terms of a national network,
This is very much on the radar of the American Physical Therapy Association. They just did a huge survey looking at asking physical therapists in different practice settings. Could they see more patients? Have they extended their hours? How long is the wait time to get a new patient? And how long is the wait time for a return visit? Because we're looking at how we can skew practice to make sure that we're meeting the demands where they need to be met. So I can tell you it is on the American Physical Therapy Association's, it is on the top of their plate for sure. I don't know about OT. And then with regards to access, I don't know if telemedicine anywhere has a faster you can get in faster via telemedicine anywhere?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we have telemedicine visits, but we are limited by State Practice Act.
Right.
So you are not allowed to cross borders.
State lines.
You're not allowed to cross state lines.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a second issue that we have here.
Mm-hmm.
So
you'd think that there'd be a practice would have, okay, we're going to have this person or this physical therapist or these physical therapists set up just for quick emergencies.
Walk-ins, that kind of thing.
And they would be flooded, I would imagine.
We've had that model before. So I guess, for example, when I worked in Portage at Divine Savior, we had a person. What are you laughing at? You're looking at me.
That was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. Yes. Well, I was still working at UW. I was contracted there.
Right.
So just like you're contracted to athletics. Mm-hmm. But we had a physical therapist who was dedicated to the emergency room.
Yes.
And when they, when someone came into the emergency room with a musculoskeletal injury, that PT was dispatched there. And we have tried in the past to have people who have same day emergent slots. You know, one of the issues is typically the people that call, they're rarely urgent slots. They're people who have had back pain for a while or, you know,
something,
something, and it's not, they don't label it as urgent. Now, all that being said, UW also has what's called a direct access clinic at Junction Road. And theoretically, those slots are supposed to be held for people with urgent questions and urgent problems. So if you're UW, you could call and ask for a direct access slot.
Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guests today. Great to have them with us. And they'll be with us right up until 12:30. We'll take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News. And then we'll be back. I am Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at physical therapy needs today with our two guests, Lori Tyne Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic, and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. Callers online with questions, so let's take some. Linda and Madison, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. My question revolves around the getting up off the floor as we age and the potential for rehabilitation. I'm in my early 70s, and even through my mid-60s, I was still able to be down cross-legged, sitting on the floor, and then stand up at will. And I just kind of took that like a good strength thing, and I always did that. But then there was things that happened. None of them major about my hip or anything like that, but that I just got immobilized for a long time, and I can no longer do that. And I would like to be able to sit cross-legged and get up by myself off the floor. And there's many other things like that, of course, putting your socks on, standing on one leg, that kind of thing. My point is how much rehabilitation can we realistically expect to, you know, solve some of these or restore some of these functions, and what are futile and how do we know?
Well, that's a great question. I don't think we know until we try. So I think it depends upon, you know, you brought up that you don't have a major injury or anything like that, and you've just probably had a decline in your strength, maybe a small decline in your mobility. It's probably easier for you to reach that goal of getting up than it is for somebody who had a very large surgery or something like that. So, A, I don't think we know until we try, and B, I think as a physical therapist, that's one of the things we identify is how significant are these impairments and how long or is it feasible for us to get you back from point A to point B. And one of the things I usually tell my patients when I see them for the first time is how fixable this is. I think this is very fixable, and I think we can fix you relatively quickly based on my examination. Or I think this is fixable, but it's going to take a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with that. And I had an experience where I hadn't gotten down on the floor for a long time because my kids are older.
See, I'm telling you, you got to do it once a month.
But and I can always get up, but I couldn't sit crisscross applesauce
right.
because of one of my hips. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, what's wrong with this hip? Why can't I sit like this? So then I had to practice it. And I continue to practice it. So I, like Jill, I'll get down on the floor and I'll sit crisscross applesauce mm-hmm. and get back up again. And when I'm getting dressed, I practiced standing on one leg and, you know, stepping into my shorts or whatever. So a lot of it comes down to just practicing this skill over and over again. Just because you can't do it today doesn't mean it's not trainable. So we approach it just like any other training program or strengthening program. You start with small steps and you work your way up.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that. I actually, in the morning when I get up, I usually, there's a chair that's a kind of a low chair. I just sit down on that to put my socks on. And mm-hmm. I probably should do it standing up.
Yeah, yeah. I have a little stool that I could sit on too, but I intentionally don't.
Yeah. All right, tomorrow morning.
There we go. There we go.
You let us know how that goes, Larry. And Linda, I would say just continue to work at it. Work on your strengthening, restoring your strength and mobility after whatever caused your immobility, and then start incorporating these skills first with the assistance of furniture, And then working on stretching and some easy strengthening and see if you can't regain those skills.
Right.
Good luck, Linda. Thank you for calling. Andy in Fitchburg, your turn. Hi, Andy.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
So my question is, I dislocated my elbow rollerblading in like 2006, and I fell backwards, hand full, or arm fully extended, tried to catch myself. I got to the ER. They said that's a no-no. important life lesson. Anyway, since then, I haven't had any issues, but I'm noticing when I operate my chainsaw, I do a lot of chainsawing for work.
Yeah.
I notice there's a lot of pain kind of at my elbow in between my radius and ulna, kind of right at that attachment point where it meets the humerus. Hmm. I'm wondering what that is and how can I avoid, you know, future discomfort when operating my chainsaw.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the elbow in and of itself, the humeral ulnar joint comprises the elbow. It is a very congruent, tight joint. It is the most congruent joint in the body. So once it's dislocated and reduced, the chances of you dislocating again are very, 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 very small. But having said that, then you lay down a little bit of scar tissue in this tight, congruent joint, and it can become problematic. So you're talking about where the radius and ulna come together right by the humerus, where you do a lot of pronation and supination, and where all those long finger tendons would originate that have to help you stabilize when you're running a chainsaw. So I think even though this has been, looks like almost 20 years, I think seeing a physical therapist or an occupational therapist that works with hands would be a really good idea for you, just to make sure that you don't lose any more mobility, if you need some mobilization, if there's some scar tissue that needs to be looked at.
Or some specific strengthening.
Yes.
So is it your dominant hand?
Yes, it's my right hand. I'm right-handed.
Okay.
And I think it's mostly due to the vibration of,
yeah,
like if I do a chainsaw for more than 4 hours, then it sort of gets, yeah, inflamed.
Can you switch hands?
Ooh, I would not want to be the person.
Be sure you have steel-toed boots.
Yeah, chainsaws are mostly built for right-handed.
Are they?
People,
okay.
Well,
see, right. Okay. Well,
but it's interesting because vibration, cold temperatures and vibration, we know bother people with what we call upper extremity work-related injuries. We know those are two of the factors, are cold and vibration. So that wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
I think seeing somebody who maybe specializes in upper extremity work, ergonomic kind of things would be a good thing to do if this is part of your livelihood.
Yeah. Yeah. They may have some other suggestions about modifications,
yeah,
gloves, anti-vibration gloves.
Yes.
That might work.
There are anti-vibration gloves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Didn't
yes,
know
there
that.
Are. Yeah. So something like that might work. So those are just some ideas.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good luck, Andy. Thank you for calling. Evelyn in Whitefish Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Evelyn.
Oh, okay. Good morning. Thank you. I have a problem with what I've heard described as trigger finger on my ring finger of my right hand specifically. And this happens when I'm doing something like weeding in a garden and pulling things with my hand turned tightly, and I can't get that finger open again unless I do what I think is sort of like a karate chop on it.
And it's very painful when you do that karate chop, I bet, isn't it, Evelyn?
Yes. Yeah. It's very painful.
Yes. So it seems to me you are describing what would be a trigger finger and what happens. And interestingly, in your ring finger is probably the most common finger to have it in. And what happens is you develop a little nodule of scar tissue, for lack of better terms, on the finger flexor tendon. And what happens is it has to ride under what we call the A1 pulley. It's basically a bridge, if you will, that holds the tendon in place. And when that knot slides on one side of the pulley, then you get stuck there. And then that knot has to go back under that pulley when you try and extend your finger. So what happens is the knot on the tendon gets stuck on either side of the pulley. Treatment includes corticosteroids injections. People can have one or two, and about 2/3 to 3/4 of people will see relief from that. The other option is to have surgical treatment on it to get rid of the nodule. It's a very quick, easy surgery. It's maybe one or two stitches in your hand, and you're back to work in pretty lickety split. And the reason I know this is because my husband, who's a therapist, had one. So he ended up with 2 injections, got better, but not where he needed to be, and eventually had surgery, and that ended up to be totally, completely fine. I believe as a physical therapist, he had to wear gloves for about 10 days to protect the incision and things like that, but he went back to work the next day.
Evelyn, there you go. Thank you for calling. Kay in Black River Falls, we're going to you now. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I was diagnosed with tarsal tunnel in my feet.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, all the doctor said was, yeah, I can do surgery on that. And that was the end of that. My feet are so numb. It hurts to walk. My feet feel very heavy. At times I get sharp pains in the side of my foot. What can I do besides surgery?
Oh, well, physical therapists treat this problem. So tarsal tunnel is sort of the foot equivalent of carpal tunnel. So it's the same situation where the mechanics and the anatomy of the foot places pressure on a nerve, causing these neurologic symptoms that you have. So I would absolutely see a physical therapist. They would look at your alignment, potentially suggest an orthotic, depending upon how things look, some range of motion and strengthening exercises. So it's in both feet?
Yeah, both feet.
Okay, and how
one
long?
One is worse than the other.
And how long has this been going on?
Oh, 2 years.
That's a long time. So a physical therapist would also do an examination to make sure that this is actually tarsal tunnel and not coming from your spine or a peripheral neuropathy problem of unknown etiology. Right. So I don't see a lot of tarsal tunnel, but it is there and it exists. So I guess the first thing I would do is want to make sure that I was actually dealing with tarsal tunnel. And if that's the case, you should be able to make some adjustments to the posture of the foot and have your symptoms improve.
Right. Unloading it should help.
Yeah.
So, right.
Yeah. And if that doesn't, then you need to start looking elsewhere as the cause of this numbness.
Good luck, Kay. Thank you for calling. Michelle in Toma emailed to say a couple of months ago she hurt her elbow while manually edging her sidewalk and driveway. The only relief Michelle gets is from ibuprofen and ice packs, but once she thinks they're improving, the pain always returns. So it sounds like it's getting better, then it comes back. She is a self-described 63-year-old postmenopausal woman.
So she was manually edging, so gripping tools and trying to get the grass out of the side by her concrete. Is that what you're thinking, Lori?
That's what I'm thinking. Yeah, I'm thinking it's the grip.
That's asking a lot of those stabilizers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if she hasn't seen a physical therapist, I would go there. If this is something like lateral epicondylitis, which is a possibility, it's tough to get rid of, especially if it's your dominant hand.
Right.
My guess it's your dominant hand. Anytime you grip, you open a door, you open the refrigerator, you lift a gallon of milk out of the fridge, all those things use the... You think they're using your wrist and hand muscles, but those muscles originate at your elbow. So you will feel it at your elbow probably more than your wrist and hand. So she needs to see a physical therapist to have a good diagnostic evaluation and then get on the right treatment program. Otherwise, it's going to be the yo-yo. I call it the yo-yo version of rehabilitation, where you feel a little better, then you stop, and then it comes back.
Right. And interestingly, they may recommend a wrist splint
her
because that's actually where you need to stabilize those tendons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Ruth in Chippewa Falls, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ruth.
Hello. I'd like to know a little bit more about the PT for osteoporosis. Who do you ask for? I never heard of this before.
So it's a great question. So we know that weight bearing and loading your bones is helpful. And it's literally, it runs along a spectrum. So for some people, if they haven't been loading very much, a walking program will be adequate loading. However, our bones are really smart, and they say after a while that, oh, I've done this before, and I'm not going to lay down any more bone, and I need something different. So then it may be a progression to some sort of multi-planar movements where you're adding some twisting or some sidestepping, things like that. It is a continuum or a spectrum. And what a physical therapist would do is find, Ruth, where you fall in that spectrum. So if you're relatively sedentary, a walking program is going to be a really good place to start because that will be an adequate stimulus for your bones. If you're somebody like Larry, who I know for a fact parks his car a mile away, so he has to walk a mile to the office and a mile back every day, a walking program is probably not going to be enough stimulus for his bone, and he would need something different. So a physical therapist would help figuring out where you are on the spectrum and where you, what kind of stimulation your bone needs.
Right. So for us, we get referrals from the osteoporosis clinic.
Right.
So those are the providers that send patients to us.
Ruth, thank you very much for calling. Michelle in Stevens Point, it's your turn. Hi, Michelle.
Yes, thank you. So my question is, I'm a caregiver for my mom. She's 3 months total total knee replacement. She's had less than 90 degrees of flexion, no problems with extension. Recently underwent manipulation under anesthesia. The surgeon was able to get her to 120 degrees. The next day in rehab, just over 90 degrees, having a lot of trouble. I think it seems like there's some sort of maybe a muscle guarding going on. And I'm wondering if you have any recommendations on how to approach that.
Oh, that is a really difficult situation. I see a lot of these patients. So, you know, we use the cryocuff, the icing machines. We work on continuous range of motion. We put them in the pool so that they can exercise and move in a limited weight-bearing environment. But if you've had that manipulation, it's really important to capitalize on that and use that knee as much as possible. And pain control is a big piece of that.
Yes. And the other thing is sometimes, Michelle, if it's muscle guarding and the patient is hesitant, sometimes it's better to have the patient move it. So occasionally you will find that if you give patients the control and let them pull with the towel, things like that, it's helpful. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would suggest is, and if you're still working with a therapist, is ask them about using autogenic or reciprocal inhibition, which is a way to inhibit muscles. That might be something that works for your mom as well. The other thing is a stationary bike. Mm-hmm. Putting them on a stationary bike, I think, is really helpful.
Right. And if you don't have a bike, you can get those little pedalers that go underneath your desk or something. For her, just moving, because you need to tell those connective tissues that they need to be moving and need to be more mobile than they are. So if you are, you know, immobile for 23 hours a day and you spend 1 hour doing rehabilitation, then that's you're telling your knee that it doesn't really need to move.
The other thing, if she's still seeing a therapist, is the therapist may consider, it would be the therapist's decision, I haven't seen your mom, to see if she's a candidate for dry needling, to see if she's got so many trigger points in her muscles that she's so tight and guarded that maybe a couple sessions of dry needling might be helpful for your mom as well.
Yeah.
There you go, Michelle. Thank you so much. James and Eau Claire, what's on your mind?
Hey, I had an accident, industrial accident, way back in 1977 and lost the fingers on my left hand, which is my dominant hand. And I get a lot of pain in my wrist. And I don't know if that's from, you know, osteoarthritis or arthritis in general or lack of blood flow. And I've had cortisone shots, but they're very short term. And I was wondering if there was any other suggestions for me.
And you lost three fingers?
Three and a half, yes.
Three and a half, okay. And did you lose them at the metacarpal joint?
At the first, no. not the main knuckle, but the first knuckle toward the tip.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. All right. So if you're obviously seeing somebody, if you're getting cortisone injections, so have they said you have arthritis in your wrist, or what is the reason for the injections?
You know, they've really never diagnosed. It's more of, hey, I got pain in my wrist, and what can we do about it? And so,
all right. Well, I guess my next step would be to figure out what's causing the pain. So is it arthritis in some joints? Was there some trauma at the time of the injury? Is there instability in your wrist? So, you know, for me, figuring out the cause of the pain, the source of the pain, is really what drives the right intervention.
And I'm thinking, Lori, if he's lost his DIP, if he's lost like a flexor, his flexor digitorum profundus, that would be a stabilizer at your, it would assist in stabilizing at your wrist. So I'm wondering if just throughout the years, if he's lost some of the stabilizers at his wrist.
Have you seen a certified hand therapist at any point?
For pain, yes. And there again, not a lot of suggestions or, I mean, I use it, still use it all the time. It's still my dominant hand. So it's not as though I'm
naming
it or anything that.
Yeah. So I guess the, you know, I would look to that person, that certified hand therapist who does this day in and day out, I would look to that person for suggestions on how to keep the function of that dominant hand across your lifespan. So figuring out what's causing it and what you need to do to preserve the function of that hand.
And have you ever tried a wrist widget? A wrist widget?
A wrist widget?
It's really hard to say. A wrist widget. It's WIDJET. It's a very, very small, minimalistic wrist stabilizer you could use. It wouldn't be the answer. It'd be like putting a Band-Aid on an open fracture. It looks better, but you haven't got to the root of the problem. But it might be helpful in some times when you are having difficulty. They're relatively inexpensive, and you can buy them off like Amazon. But I would still see someone.
Give it a try anyway. For sure.
Yeah.
Thanks very much, James, for calling. And just finally, quickly, Steve is wondering if there are any studies on the benefits of supplements, particularly glucosamine. Flesh is willing and joints don't want to cooperate.
We could have a whole conversation on that, but the take-home message is that glucosamine, even in combination with chondroitin, has not shown to be hugely beneficial. And part of that is because these are not FDA regulated, and so buyer beware. Every time you go to the store, you're getting something a little different.
That's exactly right. It's not that they don't work, but we don't have enough evidence for it because it's not well enough controlled.
And on that note, thank you both very much for being with us.
You bet. It's been fun as usual.
We'll do it in a month.
That sounds great.
Lori Zine Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. And they'll be back in a month, and we'll talk with them again. Right now, coming up, we're going to take a look at some new treatments to deal with burns. A couple of guests for you next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, every year about 40,000 Americans are hospitalized with severe burn injuries. And because burn victims require specialized treatment and long periods of recovery, the medical care they need can be very expensive. And today, we're talking about a possible new treatment for burn injuries. Join us. Couple of guests, as a matter of fact. One, Dr. Angela Gibson, a medical director of the UW Health Wound Healing Services in the Department of Surgery at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Gibson is also vice chair of research in the department's Division of Acute Care and Regional General Surgery. Dr. Gibson, welcome. Thanks for joining today.
Thank you for having me.
With us as well, Dr. Brian Pogue, who chairs the Wisconsin Institute for Medical Research Department of Medical Physics. And Dr. Pogue, welcome to you as well. Thank you for joining in.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
As we talk with our two experts, I hope you'll join in. Have you suffered from severe burns or had a loved one or close relative have that issue? How were your injuries treated? Was the recovery long and difficult? I'm sure it was. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Gibson, maybe first you could describe how challenging it is to treat burn injuries using the current methods that we have.
Yeah, it is pretty challenging in that things haven't changed a whole lot in the last, 50 years, although we've had a lot of advances in how we care for burns. It's been really challenging to translate those to humans. A lot of the studies are done in animals, and they don't always translate to humans. So we're relying on a lot of the things that we have used for many years, pretty simple washing the wounds, taking care of them, getting good pain control, and putting on some pretty simple dressings.
Yeah, and you have something like this, obviously, on the face of it, it's terrible, but there are complications that can come to the fore, Dr. Pogue, with burn wounds. Are there not?
Well, I'll probably let Dr. Gibson answer this one. I'm coming in more from the physics and engineering side.
Okay, Dr. Gibson?
Yeah, so complications with burns can be anywhere from short-term, such as infection, and delayed wound healing, and then long-term scarring that affects functional outcomes. And in addition to all of that, it's the traumatic injury itself and the trauma that people have to go through to recover from the injury, the pain that goes along with healing, and just, the emotional trauma of having been involved in a traumatic event like a burn.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're very costly to treat, partly because of the time, as you suggest. Skin grafting is attaching healthy skin to an area of severely burned skin. Why might you want an alternative to skin graft surgery, Dr. Gibson?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's actually one of the main reasons why, we're interested in developing advanced therapies to treat burns is that skin graft requires us to take skin from somewhere else on a person's body, because only your own skin can be used to skin graft a burn or a wound. And taking that donor site, as we call it, really is painful. It's basically removing the upper layers of skin and exposing the nerve endings. And then that is another wound that they have to heal in. So if there's any way that we can avoid doing that, that's why we're working at trying to develop new technologies to let people heal their burns in on their own.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Pogue, maybe a research interest of yours is photodynamic therapy. What is that, and how is it currently used?
Sure. Yeah, photodynamic therapy. It's the way to think of it is it's a light activated chemotherapy. So you can kill or damage tissue with light by giving this injectable or topical agent. And so normally it's used like in cancers or precancers to kill them. But what we've been thinking about and looking at in this new research direction is giving sort of a light version of it. If you can think about it, that old adage that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It's sort of a light. If you give a light version of it, it can actually stimulate the tissue to heal itself a little better.
And the two of you recently received, I think it was a 3-year grant, $600,000 from the Wisconsin Partnership Program to test the effectiveness of photodynamic therapy for burn wound care. Why do you think this might work?
Well, I think from just a real simplistic view, if we can increase the wound healing capacity and there's enough, you know, we change the environment of the wound to enhance that healing, I think there's definitely, it's worth trying this in to try to avoid having to take that donor site. And so we're really excited about the opportunity to potentially do this research with this Wisconsin Partnership Program grant. It was really exciting for us to receive that.
What maybe talk about what that Wisconsin Partnership Grant Program is. I'm sure a lot of people aren't familiar with it.
Yeah, so it's an internal funding through our institution that was created many, many years ago. I think they're having their 20th anniversary this year, where they basically, their mission is to positively impact the health of Wisconsin. And so they solicit for funding opportunities for various, many, many different types of research. And they have a wonderful panel that reviews them. And they include, they actually include outside members, so people who aren't specifically doing the research, but to, from the community to help understand what this impact could have for the community. So it's been a really wonderful program to provide pilot funding for various studies and new avenues of study.
This spring, you presented research on the use of delayed fluorescence on burn wound healing. And you described this as a novel approach, if I'm not mistaken. How will this, or will this new research relate to your work?
So this new research is more focused on a therapeutic, so not so much looking at how we assess the depth of the burn, but in treating the burn, and so in providing a treatment that may enhance the healing. You know, I could see in the future there could be some synergy between the two in understanding the depth of the burn, potentially to determine if this therapy would be helpful.
Yeah. Dr. Gibson, do you want to add to that? I'm sorry, Dr. Pogue.
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah. So in that work, we discovered that this photodynamic agent preferentially does exist in burn. So it's a naturally occurring molecule called protoporphyrin 9, and so that is a photosensitizer, and so we can use that to activate and deliver photodynamic therapy within burns. And just as Dr. Gibson was saying, you know, if you can stimulate the wound to heal itself a little better, then it reduces the need to do skin grafting. And so that's the gist of our focus is, can we stimulate burns to heal themselves a little bit better, and especially, you know, just burns that may be on the edge of needing a graft or not needing a graft to stimulate themselves.
At what level, I'm figure out the proper way to say this. How big an area do you need to have before, or how small an area before skin grafting comes into play?
It depends more on the depth of the burn. So if the depth of the burn is deep enough that it's removed all the regenerative capacity of the skin, and it's bigger than, say, you know, a couple of centimeters wide, and it's in a functional area, all of those things make us think that we need to do skin grafting. And so, you know, even small burns that are on the hands or the feet or the face, those, if they're deep enough, they will require skin grafting to avoid really aberrant scarring.
Our guests today, Dr. Angela Gibson and Dr. Brian Pogue, are working on a new, they have a new research grant, $600,000 grant from the Wisconsin Partnership Program, to test the effectiveness of photodynamic therapy for burn wound care. Inviting you to join in, questions about burns or questions about the research, we'd love to hear from you. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with our guests, Dr. Angela Gibson, Dr. Brian Pogue, as we talk with them about their research on burns. Just to remind you, tomorrow at this time, the Larry Mueller Show, I'll be broadcasting from the Wise Nature Center at the Beaver Creek Reserve in Fall Creek. We'll talk to Reserve Center naturalists about birds and butterflies, and then we'll be joined by the author and humorist and singer-songwriter Michael Perry. And that is tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show. Looking forward to that. In the meantime, looking forward to your questions or comments as we talk birds with our two guests. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Gibson, to determine whether this PDT is safe for treating burn injuries, you'll be testing the therapy on pigs, as I understand it. Why pigs?
Yeah, so pigs are the animal model that most closely represent human skin. And they're a large enough animal that we can do a lot of different conditions on each animal, because our goal is to do as few animal experiments as possible. But it really is important, as you mentioned, to make sure that this is going to be safe and effective before we think about transitioning to human studies.
Yeah, and I understand that you'll be working with veterinary staff at UW-Madison.
Yeah, we have a wonderful pig core facility that allows us to perform these studies in a very humane manner, and they receive wonderful care at this facility.
Yeah. Dr. Polk, how important is animal testing in medical research like this?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's essential. It's an essential step. It's not the only step. Of course, we've done a lot of research already in mice, and a lot goes on in terms of planning. But in the end, before you go to human studies, you have to try them in a living system that mimics human skin. And so, just as Dr. Gibson said, I think the swine model is the model that's fundamentally accepted all over as the best surrogate for human skin.
Wow. And if this PDT therapy, so what's the process on this? This is a long process? Well, I guess you've got 3 years of research time to spend on it, but...
Well, yeah, and so I could just say, I mean, the key is we don't know the drug dose level or the light dose level that's appropriate, right? And so that's exactly why we couldn't jump into humans use or study, because, you know, we really need to try different drug dose levels and light dose levels to figure out the sweet spot of where it works the best. Because if you overtreat, you can do harm, and if you undertreat, there's no value. So it's really, we have to find just the right level of drug and light dose that causes this effect, this sort of therapeutic effect that we're looking for.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think I mentioned there's something like 40,000 severe burns in the U.S. every year. How many do we have in Wisconsin, Dr. Gibson?
But I don't have the exact numbers in Wisconsin for all burns, but we admit about 300 to 350 burns to our burn center at the University of Wisconsin. We are the only level one adult and pediatric verified burn center in Wisconsin, and about a third of those are actually pediatric burns. And there's also a burn center in Milwaukee that does adult, and a burn center in Milwaukee and a pediatric surgical center that does pediatric burns in Milwaukee. So there's a good number of patients who do require admission for their burn injury here.
Yeah, and I had been thinking, and Joel, I know our producer today had a question about that too, and Jeff, what are the most common causes of these burns?
Yeah, I'd say the most common that people forget about all the time is putting accelerants on fires. So when people are doing bonfires and just want to get it going a little bit more, they throw gasoline and other, you know, lighter fluid, things like that, just to get it going. And that is absolutely one of the most common ways we see in burn injury. In pediatrics, we see a lot of scald injuries, usually around the year to year and a half, 2 year old, where they're getting up, moving around, pulling things off of the counters, you know, being at their parents' feet while they're cooking and stuff. So just being careful. In the winter, we see fireplace, you know, hands on fireplace for pediatric patients. But really, it's that kind of accelerant on things that I think really catches people by surprise.
Yeah, as many times as we see and hear information about it, it's well, that's not going to happen to me. I'll just throw some gas on that.
Yeah, all the time people say that. They say, I've done this all the time. It's never been a problem. And all it takes is one time.
Somebody else, we have an email here. What's the difference between first, second, and third degree burns?
Yeah, so first degree burn is like a sunburn. The upper layer of skin, the epidermis, is damaged, but it doesn't go deeper into the dermis. A third degree burn goes all the way through the dermis to the subcutaneous tissue, and that absolutely requires a surgery to heal in if it's big enough because there's nothing to heal it in. And then a second degree is this big area or this big group of burns that's anywhere from a superficial second, so it's just kind of getting a little bit into the dermis, all the way down to deep second degree or deep partial thickness burns. And those oftentimes do require surgery because they've really burned through all of the regenerative areas within the skin.
Oh, do sunburns ever get to third degree?
No, not a normal sunburn. Yeah. So sunburns do sometimes become second degree where they start to blister. If you do have blistering sunburn, that is a second degree burn.
Okay. And do they tend to undergo multiple surgeries? Because there's, I'm wondering about children here for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Is treatment for children with burns more complicated?
It is because of trying to minimize pain and suffering. I mean, obviously, we want to minimize that for adults as well as pediatrics, but there's just the margin of error is much smaller with younger kids. And so not only trying to get them in a dressing that we can change less frequently to reduce their pain, but also just the impact that a burn has on the physiology of a pediatric patient is often much more severe.
Oh. And Dr. Polga, I'm thinking back to the research that you're doing, would this be a possibility for use with young children? Oh, we think we might have lost.
I was on mute there. Yeah.
Oh.
I think ideally we would like that, but I think rarely would you want to start there. We probably start more carefully in adults. Again, Dr. Gibson might correct me there.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, most technologies that come out for all of our medical patients start with adults and then making sure that it's safe and appropriate and then testing it on pediatrics.
Boy, it's... I'm thinking it's got to be difficult with burns with kids because they're growing.
Yeah. Yeah. So the scarring can become much more problematic if they're growing and their skin isn't growing normally with them. And so we try to get them to heal in with as little scarring as possible.
Boy. Are there, here's another email, are there any home remedies you recommend for like first degree burns, or should people seek professional treatment first or second?
So for first degree burns, cooling, don't ever put ice on burns because ice will cause the blood vessels to constrict and it can deepen the severity of the burn. And so cool water for the pain control. And then if the skin is still intact as it would be with a first degree burn, just using lotion is a good way to treat that. For a second degree burn where the skin is actually sloughed off and there's blisters, washing that well, getting all those blisters off, and then treating them with an antimicrobial topical ointment and a nonstick gauze, that, if it's small enough, that can be done at home. But if the pain is too much, such that the person isn't actually washing it well to clean it, then they should seek medical professional help.
Amy in Eau Claire emailed to say they've read about sugar packing wounds and burns to increase the speed of healing. Is there anything to this method?
Not that I know of. I'm unfamiliar with that.
Sugar packing wounds. It doesn't sound like it would work for me, but how did you get interested? Let me turn to Dr. Polk. How did you get interested and involved in this burn research to begin with?
Well, I got into it through Dr. Gibson, really. My expertise is in photodynamic therapy, which is the mechanisms and the delivery of this light-activated treatment. And again, I'm more of a cancer person, but through discussions with Dr. Gibson, we realized that there's potential for this to activate the tissue. And again, you know, the original part of this, I think, is that, you know, it's a way to kill or harm tissue, but if you give just a very small amount of it, you can actually activate tissue to heal itself. And that, I think that's the key part that we're most excited about.
Yeah. And Dr. Gibson, how did you get this become an interest for you?
So burns became an interest for me. I started my career as a nurse, and my first unit that I started on was the burn unit, and I haven't left since. Became very enthralled with the patient population and the ability to see the wounds healing, and the burn survivors are just amazing people who, you know, go through such traumatic injuries and come out much stronger individuals. So I really love the patient population, and I love watching the wounds heal, and I love doing research on it.
Yeah, I would think so. I think there's got to be a mental side to this to someone who is, especially if it's a burn that is disfigured to any arms or face or something.
Yeah, it's definitely trauma that they both emotionally and physically have to be helped heal through. We have wonderful support systems for our burn survivors, and I encourage, you know, if someone does have an injury that they haven't been seen at our institution but want to get connected with our burn survivors, that they should reach out to our burn center.
Oh, and how would you do that?
They can just look up the burn center on the internet and give us a call, and we will start helping people get connected.
So UW-Madison Burn Center, something
yep.
like that, into a...
Yep. UW-Health Burn Center.
Okay. The research on this is going to go on over the next 3 years. If this proves effective for the treatment of burns, how soon might human trials start?
Well, I think that depends a little bit. I'll ask Dr. Pogue to weigh in on kind of developing the actual tools to do that.
Yeah. Go ahead, Dr. Pogue.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, it's a little unclear at this point, right? But photodynamic therapy is delivered to patients for skin treatments every day for precancerous lesions. So and the drug that we use is approved for human use, and the light delivery systems exist. So that's one of the more exciting things about this, is that if we see that it's working, the potential to translate into a human clinical trial would be seamless, you know, really quite easy.
And what would a trial consist of in like this? Usually you have a control and a treatment in a trial.
Yeah, it just depends on how the study is designed, but oftentimes we can do an intra-patient control. So the patient themselves, we would split their burn wound in half or in, you know, parts, and we would treat one part of it and not treat the other. Sometimes we don't need that control necessarily, and so it just depends on how we design the study.
So that's an interesting way to think about it. I hadn't thought about it, treating half a wound in one way and the other half in another way, and then just checking to see which one works the best.
Yeah.
That is very, very interesting. Well, what's your prognosis, Dr. Pogue? Do you think you're going to get this done in 3 years?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm very excited. I think we'll be jumping into it very quickly. And, again, we've been spending a fair bit of time working with mice, but really we've got to get to the real tissue that simulates humans in the pig model to test it out. So we'll give some answers within a year or two, for sure.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you both today. I want to thank you so much. I really thank you so much for this work. I mean, this is really important work. And I hope it leads to a better outcome for the many thousands of people that suffer burns every year. Thank you both very much for your work and for being with us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Angela Gibson, surgeon specializing in the surgical treatment of trauma and burns and surgical care, who are the UW Health Wound Healing Services in the Department of Surgery at UW-Madison. Dr. Brian Pogue is chair of the Wisconsin Institute for Medical Research Department of Medical Physics. Great to have them with us today. Well, I tell you what, it's always a team effort here, and we've got a great team. Our producers, Clara Kniper, Joel Patnaud, our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive director is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.